The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm excited to be here to introduce our author, to welcome back this author to the Free Library, and that author is Ken Kalfas. All right. Love a hometown crowd. Referred to by Salon as the rare writer who can combine keen, grounded psychological observation with visionary headiness, Ken Kalfas is the author of the novels The Commissariat of Enlightenment, a New York Times Notable Book of the Year, A Disorder Peculiar to the Country, a National Book Award finalist, and Equilateral. His short story collections include Coup de Fuge, Thirst, and PU-239, and other Russian fantasies. The recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship and a Pew Fellowship for the Arts, his works have been translated into more than 10 languages. He joins us tonight for the fifth time on this stage with his brand new book, 2 AM in Little America. And when I say brand new, this book's publication date was yesterday. In it, our author imagines a plausibly dystopian future in which young people from the United States are forced to emigrate to other countries because of large-scale civil unrest. A civil war has already taken place in this world, and it's uprooted Americans, and they are left to wonder how their country has fallen so low. Sound familiar? A review in the New York Times calls it a tense and often beautiful work of reflection on the American present and calls it a highly readable, taut novel. Tonight, Ken will be in conversation with another Free Library repeat offender, Nathaniel Popkin. His books of fiction and nonfiction include Everything is Borrowed, which he presented on our stage back in the bygone year of 2018, as well as The Year of the Return and To Reach the Spring, From Complicity to Consciousness in the Age of Eco-Crisis. He is co-editor of the literary anthology Who Will Speak for America. He was the fiction editor of Cleaver Magazine, and the writer/editor of the Emmy-winning documentary film series Philadelphia, The Great Experiment. So without further ado, and before we find ourselves boarding boats for better lives abroad, ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming Ken Kalfas and Nathaniel Popkin.
Hi, everybody. Happy to see you. Happy to be here with Nathaniel. Thank you. I'm going to read tonight from the middle of my book. I think Jason did a good job. Thanks, Jason, for that introduction. Good job of explaining what the book's about. It's about a young American migrant traveling abroad in a time when Americans aren't quite as welcome abroad as they might be these days. So I'm just going to go right into it. In my next country of residence, no one believed I was a tourist. Not at the airport when I arrived, nor when I looked for places to live and work. It was hard to find work, and then once I did, in a food processing plant, I overstayed my visa until I couldn't any longer. Further crackdowns were coming. I went to another country, and then another after that. Each move, a last-minute escape from a looming migrant center or prison. One desert border was crossed on foot with about a dozen other undocumented travelers of diverse origins, led by smugglers who did not know the way as well as advertised. The noonday frigidity broke records, yet in its lack of relief, its desolation, its stillness, and its boundless, cloudless, birdless sky, the desert was a place of strange and absolute beauty. Every one of the desperate migrants was aware of this beauty, this gorgeousness, this transcendence, this manifestation of perfect harmony, as if it were a discrete, substantial item. Its appreciation, the full purpose of human existence, even as we suffered for it. We continued on, watching our steps. Night fell. the cold like a blade slicing through every inch of our exposed skin, and a family with an elderly parent had to be left behind, still drinking in the beauty. For 10 months or so, I belonged to a crew on a container ship flying a flag of convenience. My passport wouldn't allow me ashore in most ports. The borderless, visa-free ocean was my home. The American catastrophe had meanwhile entered a new phase that drained the world of any cruel pleasure it had taken in our downfall. Now the overwhelming sentiment was pity. I followed the news with averted eyes. Around the same time, the technology used to monitor international travel and border security had matured into an airtight system, employing biometric indicators and closely networked databases. A cashless digital economy and location services embedded to nearly every electronic device made it possible for any nation to know the identity and whereabouts of every last person within its borders and determine his or her residency status, legal or not. Unsanctioned migration had become virtually impossible. Either for reasons of compassion, domestic politics, or workforce considerations, or a combination of the three, a few nations continued to accept migrant Americans. One of these, my new refuge, was a country with which the United States had few historic connections. Its principal ethnic group had never been a component of our celebrated melting pot. Its people, in turn, were mostly unfamiliar with American history, our culture, our mores, and our skin tones. Surprise sales clerks would stare when we entered their shops. Beyond linguistic specialists at the university, very few local people spoke English, and the national language's non-Indo-European roots, labyrinthine grammar, and subtle intonation system made it very difficult for us to learn. I was good at acquiring foreign languages, but I would pick up only enough for a simple conversation. We were tolerated, though. Americans came to occupy a vast enclave on the broad, marshy plain outside the capital city. Obsolete industrial buildings, abandoned data processing and call centers, landfills, and dumps sprawled across the territory. At one time, the area had been settled by workers who had come from the country's hinterlands and laid down blocks upon blocks of bungalows, shacks, tenements, and smoky, huddled family compounds. They left, and years later, Americans moved in, showing some ingenuity in improving living conditions. The newcomers jury-rigged water, sewage, and electrical systems, not always safely or in conformity with government standards, which in this outlying quarter were laxly observed. The congestion of the streets, the ramshackleness of the residential structures and improvisational dwellings, their confines, the noise and refuse, and the limited penetration of daylight were beyond most of the Americans' experience. When I first arrived, I was struck by how familiar or semi-familiar the enclave seemed. Some effort had been expended to make the neighborhood more home-like, even if the style of the buildings and the materials used in paving the streets and sidewalks were utterly native to this country. Unofficial signage was posted in English alongside the local undifferentiable squiggles. The principal street was lined with hamburger shops and frozen yogurt stores, some of which assumed vintage American brand names and a limited version of their former signage and trade dress. The enclave was usually identified by a tortuously anglicized rendering of its original unpronounceable name. No one called it Little America, but that's how it was thought of by its inhabitants, or at least that's how I thought of it. I soon learned that the Americans had also imported their divisions. This was inevitable, I suppose. None of our divisions had been erased. The circumstances of living together in a single enclave, however, made it difficult to isolate the political sides geographically, as they were often separated in the states. Some buildings, some neighborhoods, and some places of business went one way or another. Unpredictably, we basically lived on top of each other. This resulted in a constant low-grade insecurity, a buzzing tension. The parties no longer had a country to fight over, So the former paramilitaries had reassembled themselves, the criminal gangs still affiliated with their political convictions. Even if those convictions were irrelevant in this new place and barely recalled, you see their men around everywhere. Shortly after I arrived, while I was exhausting my money at a primitive boarding house, I went for a long walk through the district, trying to get my bearings. The streets were full. People wore their clothes in the American style, and their faces were recognizably American. They addressed each other in English with familiar regional accents. It was a relief to hear the language spoken, especially by small children, most of whom, I guessed, hadn't been born in the States. Passing a small factory that had been turned into a primary school, I heard familiar jump rope rhyme in the yard. If I closed my eyes, I might have thought I was home, for a few moments at least, before being disabused by everything else that was strange about the place. On the main shopping avenue, a hamburger restaurant called itself by the name of the most famous American hamburger brand, which had gone out of business years earlier. The custom-made signage wasn't quite right, and neither were the indoor furnishings, which attempted to replicate the uber-familiar furnishings of the original. They, too, had to be made from scratch, of course, or scavenged from unrelated local businesses. I ordered a burger. I was stunned by how expensive it was and how nasty. Nothing like the hamburgers I thought I enjoyed. Fries were unavailable. Back on the street, I realized that many food and retail outlets had adopted retired brand names, in some cases the names of businesses unrelated to the items they were selling. A sporting goods store had taken on the name of a former supermarket chain. An auto repair shop called itself after a popular jeans brand, with an attempt at the jean brand's logo in the signage. The names had evidently once meant something. They had each expressed a specific outlook about the world. And we considered our purchases acts of self-expression. In those days, in America, one might have assigned a specific character to a person quite reliably by where he or she shopped and by the brands he or she valued. You'd probably tell how he or she voted. Men with guns could tell too. Okay, thank you.
That was great.
Thanks, everybody.
Now for the interrogation.
Okay, now for the interrogation.
I think we both want to say, like, kind of amazing to be here in a room with other people.
Yeah.
Wow, I'm almost floored. Shall we talk?
Yeah, sure. All right. I sing, but yeah, let's talk.
I mean, you could sing maybe. Yeah. I don't know. Uh-huh. So, your work until this book seems to name some moments in the history of our experience, recent history mostly. They're basically all coup de foudre, right? They're all lightning strikes. 9/11, okay. DSK's hotel room, the beginning of the Russian Revolution. These are your subjects. And it seems like this might be following that pattern, but a little differently. You want to talk about?
Well, I think that in those books, in many books that I've written, or things I've written, I'm very much often inspired by things in history, and particularly how it relates to whatever moment we're living in. I think current history is in our faces all the time, and in many ways reflects how we think about the world, about how it infiltrates our private lives, which was a theme of a disorder peculiar to the country. So right now, as I was writing this in the past couple of years, during the Trump years and everything, like many people, I was wondering, you know, where could we be going? Where might we be going? So in that respect, yeah, very much, my work not exclusively, but is often inspired by history, past or current. And usually the way past history, sometimes how the way past history is reflected in the current history.
And you also speak to specific moments of change that are ruptures.
You know, because that's where the drama. That's where drama is, and that's where the drama is, and that's where things are revealed. I think, you know, if you look at the, my first novel, the Russian Revolution, it was set in time before the Russian Revolution, where a new world was coming to being, and that world, in my novel at least, is somewhat defined by the saturation of media, of image-rich media. In that movie, it's filmmaking. But I was very much thinking of when I was writing it of the media world we live in now, or we lived in when I was writing it. The television, 24/7 news, 24/7 news, and what that did to our relationship with history.
And actually, that's what, when we did Who Will Speak for America, that was basically what you produced for that anthology, was 3 days, I think?
Yeah.
The life of the Trump era.
Yes.
And it's almost like chaotic strangulation of stuff coming out, and we included like the shooting of Steve Scalise in the baseball game. And
I picked 3 days at random. That that Nathaniel asked me to write something, so I sat down. I didn't know what I would write, and said, "Well, let me do a diary of these 3 days." Actually, I did 7 days actually, but I only gave you 3 days.
well, good, thank you.
What happened in our lives, in our public life, in those 3 days, and what I thought about it, how I was responding to it at that moment.
And this continues that response, I take it.
I haven't thought about it in terms of that, but yeah. Obviously, I feel like I was very much had all what was happening in our public life on my mind while I was writing this, and what could happen, but also other things, partly the Yugoslav war, and how that civil war was a civil war I knew a little bit more about.
Which informed the way you thought about what might happen here?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. That's what I... my wife Inga and I spent a first year of the Yugoslav Civil War in 1991-92 in Belgrade in Yugoslavia. Great country. Now 6 great countries, but but it was just shocking to see what people, intelligent, smart, intelligent, literate, good-natured people can do to each other when caught in tribalistic politics, and that was on my mind well before I began this book. But yeah, that really moved me,
and so it informs this book, and as does our ongoing experience of this country fragmenting and creating chasms between each of us all the time. And yet there's something different going on here, and the passage that you read brought that to bear to the reader, I think, and that is most of it, unlike in your other novels, where there is extreme specificity and the naming of things because they bleed into the personal life so much. Here, you push it away. You mute the names. You mute the dates, you mute the faces even. Your narrator, Ron, he can't keep track of the women he's pursuing and who they are and how they relate to his past. So what's going on with that?
Okay, so part of the, part of what I was, so I would say that what I was aiming at in the novel, and there is a lot of perhaps hopefully not maddening, a lot of vagueness. That I hope is still, my hope story still carries itself along. I wanted to somehow capture the derangement of exile, that where everything is not what we know. Now, as Americans, most of us who are Americans, you know, many of us have lived abroad or traveled abroad. But when you're American and you're out in the world, you're basically an expat. You can usually come back, usually have the right papers, usually surrounded by America. I was thinking this shirt I wear, which I kind of like. I bought in a Gap outlet opposite a medieval Buddhist temple in Shanghai. But it was a Gap outlet, you know. So everything's like
it's no. It went you know, with you. America went with you.
Everything goes with you. Know, things are always familiar. The furniture is familiar, but one can imagine. This is what I try to do here, imaginatively, being a migrant, not having that country with you, and also trying to imagine a time. Is that you know we assume we're always going to have America will always revolve around America, but maybe it won't. You know, and if things go bad here, you can imagine a time when we're not the most important country in the world, where everyone doesn't listen to American music. Or speak English.
Well, the vagueness is a remarkable part of this book, actually, and it's worth reading for the evocation of the exiles, the refugees' experience of not really being able to interpret what that person is experiencing. Has no basis for understanding the political landscape, the geographic landscape, the ethnographic landscape, any of those things. That's what you've rendered here. And I assume that was the intent.
Yeah. No, I wanted to make it, create the strangeness of being an American abroad, of being a migrant, and then translate it into the American experience.
Without forgetting, as your passage led off with, the human part. Like it was across the desert was remarkable, it was beautiful, it left people behind, but it had this. Ron kept it in his mind. Mm-hmm. I assume mm-hmm. for many years after mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. experience.
Yeah. I mean, I would say the human. You know that it's a pretty cool book. I don't go. You know, but we're all aware of how difficult in this day and age. You know how difficult the life of the people on the move, migrants on the move. How difficult that life is. And I wanted to make sure he was aware of that. That passage has its own magic realism to it, but it's not a realistic description of it, yeah.
But you're right, because the most remarkable thing for me, actually, about the book is coming out of it with the sense that there's been a political rupture, who knows how long ago, exactly what happened or what. He's in a place, we don't know where it is. We have places in our minds we can assign to the enclave or the city where it is or the other city where he was with the Corniche and everything. Nice touch. But what is Ron mostly concerned about?
So,
getting laid?
No, actually, I think his most concern is survival.
Is survival.
And that's actually, he says early on that like, is laughably, it's been so difficult he's a young man, maybe in his 20s, but he's also, I would say he's pretty much given up on romantic attachment.
But I didn't get that at all, actually. Uh-huh. I mean, because he says specifically, he imagines that in the one woman I don't want to give this away, but he imagines that they could have a life together.
And
it's still in there.
He's been giving that thought to this one woman who maybe it's many women. Maybe it's, I keep again, a little bit of vagueness here. There's one woman or several women whom he's in love with, and her image or her person is scattered throughout the novel. Like many migrants, his loneliness is real. His loneliness is real.
It is, and his wanting to live day to day, to work, I got the sense that there's a way in which the precarity of human beings on Earth isn't just an abstract thing that people experience, but they still have to be mothers and daughters and bachelors.
He's lost his family, he's lost his friends, he can't make friends because of his situation. I mean, in the first place he's actually afraid to mention to people he's an American because people are like, he tells them he's Canadian.
Which is typical.
Precarity. I think he's a very lone. Again, this is another part of the experience of being a migrant. And I'm thinking a little bit of Eastern European Jews who came to America. You know, I mean, if you read like Isaac Bashevis Singer, these migrants, these Jews who emigrate and then just sort of scattered around New York, and then they see somebody on Upper Broadway and say, "Wait a minute, is that someone from home or not?" You know, and that was sort of in.
And in your novel, it's like, well, there are these names, and maybe.
Well, there's also a bit of a plot going on, which I want to discuss. I mean, I'm hoping people will read it.
But I can't tell.
Yeah, but I mean, there is what I refer to in my notes as hugger-muggery. hopefully it isn't when you read it, but, you know, sometimes there are things happening and people are hiding their real identities.
But it's super real. Like, I had the experience of reading, first of all, Rona, my wife, has worked with refugees for a long time, so I understand what this is all about. And also, I had the experience of reading a manuscript by a Cambodian refugee who settled in Philadelphia at some point, maybe in the 1980s, and he tells a story of escaping the Khmer with his mother on foot, and then they were in detention camps, and it was like, but what did he have with him? A dog. He had a dog. And you describe Ron sleeping in a room full of other people with his dog next to him. That is exactly the experience of this person in that moment. So, but I think that speaks to how real this is within the vagueness.
You know, now we're reading about Ukraine.
Ukraine, enough.
You know, I mean, there's people are trying to bring their pets, which have an important element to their not feeling lonely, not feeling feeling part of something. And I think many of us who have pets, I don't, but I know many people get a lot of solace and companionship and love from their pets.
And this isn't the first pet you've placed into your...
Yeah, I know. There's a dog in...
I've never seen you with a dog.
Yeah, I don't...
Or Inga. but
I like dogs. I don't like... I don't never want to have a pet, per se. I think dogs are great. I live near the dog park at Taney, at the Schuylkill River Trail. And one of the great things that no one ever really expected was they built a dog park there and a bridge. And those, I'm sure, you know, Philadelphians here, you know, almost like by chance, the bridge became a great observation place to watch the dogs in the dog park. And people who have no dogs, and particularly small kids, just love watching. I love watching those dogs. I mean, you know, they fetch they fetch balls, they catch them. I always say to myself, sign them up, you know.
we could use some arms.
You know, the dog plays an important role for him, a kind of companionship later on in the novel.
And the dog does something special in regard to the novel. Do you want to read that little?
You know, there's a pivotal. I had forgotten. We met talked about it in the back room, and the dog. He's walking the dog, and the dog takes an immense poop. While some gangsters may be watching him, I wave the leash in the dog's face. I wonder where the poop is coming from. Its mass seemed to approach the total weight of the dog. Where had she stored it? How long had it been accumulating? The dump, with its steeples and its turrets, its well-defined stories and wings, its apparently purposeful recesses and protrusions, looked almost like a piece of architecture. I gazed at it, trying to extract meaning. How would the dog behave after she rid herself of this excess matter? Would there be a personality change? I studied the poop's clumps, fanciful whirls, and little sparkly bits of undigested food. Perhaps the shit was something else. Not a building, but rather a multi-tiered, multi-walled, messily stacked up reverie of human history. So, that's my dog's, my dog, my dog, and it ends up having a pivotal, that poop is pivotal to the plot.
You said it.
As actually most poops are, really, if you think about life.
In the history of the world, I think.
The history of the world, yeah.
So the poop takes place in a parking lot. So you had the unique opportunity to try to think about what aspects of American meaning and culture would be transported to such an enclave, to Little America. And you identified some of those in the passage that you read, the brands, the hamburger joints, frozen yogurt, big box stores too.
Okay.
The only, I mean, you don't name a lot of things in this book. You don't name the political parties or the real or the divisions or any of those things. You name a store.
Mm-hmm.
You name Target.
Mm-hmm.
Random or?
Originally the title, yes. I mean, originally I thought it would, I knew a big box store would be an important part of this. And originally, I thought of Target because of the two different meanings it has. I was actually thinking of calling the novel The Target. I think of a lot of ideas for titles.
What happened? It worked out well.
Okay, yeah. Thanks. And yeah, so I had the idea that one of the features of the American landscape are big box stores. But I should just say in this novel, without getting too far into it, too much away, what happens in these shrines to big box store, or what appears to be shrines to big box stores, pop up around the enclave. And as I indicated in the passage I read originally, these brands came to have meaning to Americans during the breakdown of the civil order in America, and those shrines, big box stores, that's what you call them. They all have political symbolic meanings that are contested by the militias that still roam through the enclave.
And they're not really functioning as stores at all.
They're not functioning as stores at all. It's very hard to buy stuff there, actually, yeah. In the enclave in general. I mean, you can't get... I mean, people are really poor. I don't dwell on it too much, but there really isn't things have to be made. There's like no bookstore. There's a library, something that serves as a library towards the end of the book. But yeah, it's a very primitive... exists as is for many, I was talking about Eastern Europe earlier. American, East European Jews came to America. They couldn't use Yiddish, which was their main language, their first languages. And it became something that people didn't know, people didn't speak. Language died out. And so I think that may have been on my mind when I was writing this.
Yeah, I think all of those things that we kind of understand about the refugee experience historically filter into this.
Yeah. I try to, yes, yes.
Should we go to audience? It's time for you all to ask Ken your questions.
Thank you very much, Nathaniel and Ken. I'm Anna. I have a question about narrative. We have been reading plenty of stories about immigrants written by immigrants into the United States. I'm thinking of Mbolo Mbui's Behold the Dreamers. I'm thinking of No Violet Bulawayo's How Beautiful We Were. What this narrative does is it jars us open to the idea of, okay, fellow Americans, especially fellow white Americans, so you've been reading all these stories by people who don't look like you. Here's a story about people who look like you and are you in a different setting. And I appreciate and recognize all the kind of inside jokes, you know, the life of an expat, the furniture that's not quite there, the over-expensive hamburgers. But what I'm curious about is ladies and gentlemen, this book is sold out, by the way, so we hope that it makes a huge difference in the psyche of the public. But I'm wondering what actually writers in this country can do to dramatically affect the understanding of what migration means and what it means to leave everything behind or lose your family and lose your friend and the dog is the only thing you have. What does that mean? How do writers reach beyond the bubble of this beautiful, beautiful bubble of the Free Library of Philadelphia? Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks. I would just say the book's experience isn't limited to white Americans. And I also say, and I should stress this, that this book has very little documentary value. What I hope to do with the book is have imaginative value by creating something that we know is not correct, a counter narrative to what we have of our history, to make us think a little more about the world we live in, and without, you know, I don't offer any kind of solution to the ongoing crisis of forced human migration, but I'm hoping to do is imaginatively make us think, or make me think actually, about what it might be like to be not a privileged American. Not in a documentary way, but in a almost fanciful and occasionally humorous way. I think the subject that you mentioned is the, you know, one of the main issues of our time. One of the, you know, 21st century is a century marked by forced human migration. And there's a lot of ways to think about it, and, you know, probably, you know, and there's great reporting, there's great memoirs, there's great global views of the issue. And I try to do my little postmodern, slightly comic way and add to thinking about it. That's all I have.
You did the simple task of turning something, Chinatown, Little Italy, Little America. Like, that's really our job as writers, right? Like, is to frame something for people differently in a way to allow them to see in ways that they weren't able to see before.
If we can, yeah.
If we can.
Yeah, if we can, yeah. I mean, yeah. Always, you know, something
Oh yeah, that's a way of thinking about it. Yeah. That I haven't thought that won't necessarily be in the newspaper. Definitely won't be in the newspaper. That's why we look at fiction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the role of fiction.
Thanks for the question.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for reading. The book is definitely a migrant story, but it is it felt like a very American story too. I mean, you sort of the migrant has you hear in speeches and stuff like that the idea that America is an idea, but if America is only a memory or an abstraction, what is that? And the fact that it is a shrine to a target, like that's what's left. But there is also, that's not something that's just left over afterwards. That's something that you talk about being in the lead up, is the symbology of what you wear, how you walk in school. Every single thing is identifiable as some partisan faction. The idea of the sort of like the fixation on symbols that happens when that's all you have. I mean, after the dog poop, there's the conversation about the semiotics of a dog pooping, right? And the symbology of it. And it's like, spent a lot of time thinking about that. But was that part of it too? Was this sense of what you're left with when all you can take with is sort of your ideas about where you come from and things like that?
Yeah. Thanks. We have these ideas about what America is, and or what, in this case, what America was, and it's maybe a little hard. Well, it is hard. I mean, you think about other migrant groups, other people who have left their countries that no longer exist. And does it off? I'm thinking about. I just thought about Nabokov, who always mourned the Russia that he left as a child. I think if ex Yugoslavs travel in the world and they hear a little bit of a song or a pastries. Sometimes you're traveling and you see a pastry that's from home. I mean, again, this is the difference between American. You can go anywhere in the world almost. I mean, I was once on a college campus outside of Cairo. I saw a place called Jared's Bagels. And, but if you're from a small country, if you're from a country that's been destroyed, or because the country is no longer, then those little signs, those little become very important. And if you go northeast here, and there are little stores that have Russian pastries and things that really bring stuff from home. There's a fabulous Turkish produce place on 4th and Bainbridge.
I get all my stuff there.
Queen Village Market's called, right? And they sell, and they fly in baklava from Turkey. So, that's a great thing. If that's what people respond to.
And they have a table outside with chairs just like in Istanbul.
Yeah, they're rickety.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder, just following up on Justin's question, are we left only with these kind of surface meanings? I mean, we're struggling here with this country right now, and
that's a good question. Actually, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, what does it mean? What are the things that I grew up thinking was functions of our liberal democracy, or have become partisan, things we no longer agree about. So. One can imagine, and this has probably happened in places like, again, Yugoslavia or other countries. I mean, what did it mean? What did the shtetl mean in Eastern Europe after it was all destroyed? People had their food. They had their neighbors who were, they lost their neighbors. They lost their contacts. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think Ron really holds on to anything specifically. aside from memories of high school and people?
I think there's a joke early on where he says he kind of missed an independent judiciary.
A good joke. We miss it also. Yeah. Timely joke.
Timely joke, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
As you were reading, it was really interesting. I just had these layers of imagery, and it's related to, I think, what Nathaniel was talking about the vagueness allows you to absorb. I mean, it'll be interesting when I read it on the page, how that feels, but some of the things that you've already talked about, you know, what is the immigrant experience in America for immigrants, crossing the desert, adopting to a new country, coming with nothing, all those, and also, I did also think about, oh, but we're a country of older immigrants, and there are stories of like all the people who have been descended from immigrants, and we define ourselves that way. But the other image that came to mind was of the movie Nomadland, and I was thinking about how, you know, there's this dispossession that is taking place in our country on American soil, where there are people who belong here and feel in some way they belong here, but are also dispossessed and disenfranchised and don't really have a solid, secure life. And I was wondering if that was anything also that you were thinking of.
I have not seen that movie, but I'm certainly aware of it. I mean, I was thinking, you know, I mean, about this contemporary world we live in, not necessarily America, where people are in some way alienated from the society they're in, whether they're migrants or they're not. There's something common about poverty in some respects. So all those ideas sort of were part of my thinking when I sat down with the book. Thanks. Yeah,
and it's all there. So. Welcome back to life. I think we're out of time, right?
We're getting there. People have more questions.
Oh, we can do one more? Okay.
We have time. People have talk questions.
I didn't get a chance to totally finish the book yet, but you took my question because I was also thinking about Nomadland and a little bit about what the first question was.
Well, thanks for starting it.
You have to watch that movie, because that's exactly what I thought about when she was asking her question, which is there are so many people dispossessed in this country, but we constantly want to just make things about race or something like that. We have so many
about
race, for instance, when we have people that are dispossessed of all kinds of races in our country. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. My friend Jim has worked at the Walmart for 25 years. So when you were thinking about the novel and kind of how we flip things as Americans, how much were you talking about class also?
I was thinking it's a good question. I'm not sure my answer is going to be right. It's going to be spot on there. I was thinking mostly of, I mean, this is back to Anne's question. I was thinking about class. I was thinking mostly about all Americans who are exiles. I mean, this is how I would answer that question. If your country's falling apart, and if you can't take stuff out with you, all of you immigrants, all of you forced migrants, are all of a sudden in a class of society or in a single class. So, you know, given the strictures of their existence, the contingencies, the difficulties living where they are, they don't really relate to each other, at least in my novel, by class. Because in the conception of my novel, it's the emigration that makes them all a single class. Now, you can come back and say, well, in our world, you know, people forced to emigrate, and some of them do bring their wealth with them or have some sort of class connections. But for the purposes of the novel, I did not. I mean, the Americans are so out of the global mainstream, whatever connections they, and they just been through a civil war, that whatever they had before isn't transferable
to borders. And in fact, okay, now that we're talking about this, I'm warming up to this. This is very largely the true experience of Eastern Europeans who came west after the collapse of the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia and elsewhere. All of a sudden, their degrees didn't mean, they had advanced degrees, they didn't mean anything. They may have had an apartment in Warsaw, the given state, or Moscow, didn't mean anything. So there was this leveling. Losing your home levels a lot of the signifiers of class. That's, I think, what was in back of my head in creating that. But thanks for the question. I've articulated now in a way that I may not. That I know I didn't do it in my notes. thanks.
Well, that's a great answer, actually.
It's interesting. It's an interesting question. Yeah. I could probably think some more about that. Actually.
But it happens all the time. Like people come with degrees or having had experiences of middle class or even upper middle class, and then it's flattened.
Although
I think there's things that are retained. Class divisions retain. Communal divisions retain. When a whole village assembles in South Philly, for example, from wherever, Burma or something, those divisions remain.
Maybe. I was thinking, and I must have been on my mind of the East European migration at the end of the communist era.
Yeah.
I think that's what I'm thinking of being in a taxi here in Philly with a driver who has a physics degree, and over and over and over again. And I'm sure there are people from other parts of the world who have the same kind of loss of not only status but identification. So I want to think about that some more. But thank you.
Astonishing. I think you've opened up a door for us here.
Okay.
That's what this book does. Thank you.
And a lot of the questions here have opened up doors for myself, so I can think more about what I was trying to do.
And now a door will open, and you will sign books of the sold-out first printing of this book. So congratulations on that.
Okay, thank you.
Anna said.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.